So welcome. At the moment, if you noticed on the calendar, the only scheduled things that are showing up on the calendar are in the morning, but we will be having some kinds of afternoon sessions from time to time. And we'll announce those later. We won't have anything this afternoon. We were hoping, editors of this book, we're hoping that this book, which was the proceedings of the IAS special year from a couple years ago, would be out in time for everybody who wanted one to have gotten a copy by now. But they've only just arrived back from the printer. So there's one copy in Santa Barbara, to my knowledge, and it's here. And I'm willing to let people borrow it and look at it. I'd sort of like to treat it as a resource for the conference as a whole. So I might put it in the library, depending on whether that seems like a good idea. I haven't talked to Deborah about that yet. Or else I might just keep track of who has it, and if you give it to somebody else, you need to tell me that you've passed it on to somebody else. Any other organizational things you guys can think of? There will be a meeting, I believe it's after the second lecture this morning, but it might be after the first, but I think it's after the second, lecture. A little tour of the ITP and distribution of keys and signing of forms and all sorts of things like that. So we'll have a lecture at 9, and then we'll have another one at 10:45, and at the conclusion of the second one, before lunch starts, everybody will get their offices and things of that sort. So I'm pleased to introduce Robert Dykraff for the first of his series of lectures on matrix theory.
Yeah, so I was planning to use my these lectures to try to explain as much as is kind of possible of what we understand of non-perturbative string theory. That is kind of the formulation of string theory that goes beyond the formulation in terms of Riemann surfaces. But this is a subject very much in development. So at some point, today I want to kind of say some very general things. And then we move to explicit examples. Matrix theory is one. Perhaps I will also say something about string theory in, let's say, hyperbolic spaces or anti-de Sitter spaces later. But what I want to do today is kind of set out a little bit what is the general problem, and then actually spend some time on discussing very elementary some elementary aspects of conformal field theory that will come back later in the lectures. Also, I feel that certainly since we're kind of all here interested in this kind of interface between the mathematics and the physical intuition, I really invite everybody to ask questions and see this also perhaps some of my remarks just as a starting point for a discussion. And so please interrupt and or add details if you feel I'm leaving something out. So the first thing I want to discuss is this aspect that is perhaps not kind of universally appreciated is that string theory is somehow a deformation of classical geometry by using two deformation parameters. And which is related to the fact that I feel there's kind of three levels of which we can discuss the interaction between, say, let's call it quantum geometry, the interaction between quantum mechanics and geometry. And the first one is the most kind of the most classical one is the usual quantum mechanics. Or actually, I will often do the case of supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which is just the theory of particles. Or we think of points in a manifold. So what you typically have is that we start with some kind of say some Riemannian manifold X. Today I will discuss the case of compact. Compact Riemannian manifold, say, of dimension d. And if we consider particles, of course, we're looking at points in the manifold, say, points A or B, and then a particle can go from A to B along a trajectory with some time t. And this classical picture in quantum mechanics translates into two things. First of all, a Hilbert space. So one way to think about quantum mechanics is that it associates in some kind of canonical way to every manifold X in Hilbert space, so H, that in the case of ordinary mechanics we'll you should take the space of L2 functions, but for supersymmetric quantum mechanics, it's just a ring of differential forms on X. And the second ingredient is that to each path going from A to B, so which is abstractly can denote by this line segment of length T, there is a unitary operator, evolution operator, U of T, going from H to H. And this operator should satisfy a gluing law, which is the fact that if we glue two of these ends together, so we have T1 and T2, this should be equal to the single one with length T1 plus T2. And so this elementary gluing operation tells us that these unitary operators, these evolution operators, can be written as exponentials, where H is the Hamiltonian. And in the case of the ordinary supersymmetric or non-supersymmetric quantum mechanics, this is minus the Laplacian, or just the commutator of the operator. So given this Hamiltonian acting on this Hilbert space, which is the essentially set of quantum mechanics, we can look at the ground states. And ground states, of course, are states which have eigenvalue 0 under this Hamiltonian. And in terms of, say, classical geometry, these are the harmonic forms on the space X and just can be identified with the cohomology classes of X. Now, another thing that you can compute from this quantum mechanics, if you want to think about this quantum mechanics as somehow physics of diagrams or Feynman diagrams, then the next interesting diagram is, say, the circle. So the one loop diagram, circle of length T, in this kind of formalism, we associate a partition function z of t being the trace in the Hilbert space of e to the of this unitary evolution operator u of t, if that actually makes sense, this trace. And that from the partition function we can read off the spectrum, so the eigenvalues and the degeneracies of the Laplacian. Now, of course, a second slight generalization of this operator, or this quantity. In the supersymmetric case, we also have an operator F, which will be just the degree of the differential form, and so we can compute the Witten index being just the trace of minus 1 to the F times U of T. And this, of course, something which does not depend on T and can be identified with the order number of X. So it's something to keep in mind, that in the simplest way, the simplest quantity somehow to extract from supersymmetric quantum mechanics is the Euler number, something that will come back many times when we look at much more complicated spaces. And one thing to keep in mind is that at some point, since we somehow lack a general picture of what string theory is, we have to go to certain, say, corners of parameter space where we sometimes can use ordinary quantum mechanics to represent part of the dynamics of the theory, and then typically that means that we at some point are led to compute these Euler numbers. So this is kind of the story for quantum mechanics. And so the next step up, say, in this hierarchy of levels of quantum geometry, so the second step is to look at conformal field theory of, say, or really the theory of strings, by which we mean one-dimensional extended up, so really loops in X. I guess this is something that Graham will talk also about, but let me just go through the formalism a little bit. So now we have a manifold X, and our basic kind of object is not a point in X, but it's a little loop. And if you have two of these loops, we're looking at, say, Riemann surfaces sigma that go from one loop to another loop. And again, the rules of quantization now tell you that to this manifold we again associate a Hilbert space H, but now the Hilbert space is much bigger because it's, at least in some formal way, it would be the L2 functions on the loop space of X. That is in the non-supersymmetric case. And in the supersymmetric case, we have this we have to look at differential forms, and somehow the right thing to do is to look at differential forms of half infinite degree, so which somehow sit around the middle degree if you take some finite dimensional approximation of the loop space of X. Now, in this setup, we get more than just the time evolution operator. At least two interesting operators to consider. The first thing is that there's a natural S1 action, which is just the rotation on the loop. So it acts on loops which are we have parameterized loops, X of sigma. And since we do closed strings, the sigma runs from 0 to 2 pi. And we have an operator which I call P, which is just dd sigma, which is this generator of rotating loops. So that's one operator that certainly will act on our Hilbert space. And the second operator is, say, the Hamiltonian, which we would be some kind of a Laplacian on the loop space. Now, these are often, of course, combined in operators which we call L0 and L0 bar, which are just the linear combinations H minus P, and these are, say, the left and the right moving Hamiltonians, the things that... And so these are the things that act, these operators you can think of as being represented as infinitesimal versions of this little cylinder diagram, which just describes the propagation of a single string. Now, one of the beautiful stories about lifting the quantum mechanics to two-dimensional field theories or conformal field theories or sigma models is that we are not restricted to this topology of a cylinder. We can have other topologies. In particular, we have this kind of pair of fence diagram out of which we can construct by just gluing basically all Riemann surfaces. And the important thing is that this diagram is something that this is a map from H to H, but this will be a map from H tensor H to H. And this induces some kind of multiplication on the Hilbert space. So here we get the familiar story of vertex. Say it will be some vertex algebra. A well-known story in conformal field theory that won't be really an essential part of what I'm be telling you about today. So the analog of the one-loop diagram in quantum mechanics is now taking the cylinder and gluing the two ends together. So this is the one-loop Riemann surface, or the genus 1 Riemann surface, the two torus. And to that we will now associate a partition function, z, which depends on a complex parameter tau and its complex conjugate, which is the trace in the Hilbert space, say of q to the L0, q bar to the L0 bar, where q is, as always, is e to the 2 pi I tau. And, of course, the beautiful thing of this object is that it will be a function of this complex parameter tau. So tau takes value in the upper half plane, but there's an action of the modular group. So there's an action of SL2z on tau, sending it to fraction linear combinations. And this partition function will be invariant under these transformations. And I should stress that in the quantum mechanics case, there's no obvious way in which this function has functorial properties on the T. Of course, here the really essential thing, and we need that at quite a few points, is the non-trivial transformation is the transformation tau to minus 1 over tau, which is really essential point is that if you look at the torus as a rectangle with opposite ends identified, there are two different ways in which you can pick your time coordinates. So we can either think of time running like this, so our time coordinate t, or we can think of it as running like that. And that's a very non-trivial statement about two-dimensional quantum field theory, is that somehow viewing it as a propagation in this direction or that direction is equivalent. So this is kind of the usual setup of conformal field theory. And course, we don't have to restrict ourselves to these particular pair of Penn's diagram. We can actually take a general Riemann surface. But this is this kind of functorial way of looking at two-dimensional conformal field theory stressed by Graham. Is that when we have such a Riemann surface sigma, say of genus G, with n incoming and m outcoming boundary components, we are not naturally associated this on map A of G, depending on the genus, which is a multilinear map, sending the nth tensor product of the Hilbert spaces to the nth tensor product of the Riemann surface. And this, just as this one-loop partition function was a non-trivial function of tau, this genus G amplitude will be a non-trivial function of the moduli of the Riemann surface. Sorry, yeah. So we have these functions A of G, the generalized partition function, and this is some, in general, will be a function on M of G, which is the, is the moduli space of Riemann surfaces.
It doesn't go from the space to itself, so you can't take the trace unless you have the same number of it going in.
Precisely. So there's a, if you wish, you have to, with these, even if you're like a closed Riemann surface, it's not necessarily is obtained by gluing things together. So if you wish, the axioms of conformal field theory are such that to a closed Riemann surface you just associate some particular number. And in certain cases, of course, you can glue it from, if you wish, you can glue it from, if you have these kind of things together with kind of a cap to put on the ends, then you can make a Riemann surface out of that. I guess the most important although we can kind of study conformal field theories in generality, the important thing is that in many applications string theory, we really want to think about a conformal field theory associated to a particular manifold. And the important point to stress is that we not just are given a conformal field theory for the manifold, but in a natural way we get a one-parameter family of conformal field theories. So, if you wish string theory, perturbative string theory gives you a one-parameter family of two-dimensional quantum field theories. So, and the traditional name for this parameter is alpha prime, which is a positive real number. And the idea is that alpha prime is essentially the size of the manifold X. So when we're looking at the loop space of the manifold, there's kind of a natural question is how big are the loops compared to the size of the manifold? That's, of course, something which kind of didn't really enter the game when we studied points in the manifold. But now if you have little loops, they have some kind of a typical size. So there's a notion called the string scale, which we typically know as L of S. And L of S is related to alpha prime as being the square of this. And that's just a given length. And now you can ask, so intuitively you want to think about the manifold X and that a typical loop has kind of size L string. And now since we assumed that our manifold was compact, this is kind of the issue, how big is the string compared to the size of the manifold? But that's a kind of a natural way. And clearly if this size becomes very, very small, somehow we're looking at point or strings which are concentrated in smaller, smaller, smaller volumes, and in some limit we're actually looking at point-like or constant loops. So one way to see this is that if you look at the classical action of a sigma model, so just if you write down the classical action, we have some action S, say, of X, where X is a map, say, from our Riemann surface into the target space X. the classical action would be something like the integral, or say these two threads, sigma, we have some coordinates, and then we write, well, I can even write it more invariant, we have some metric dx I. And there will be, say, some constant in front, and here's the place where alpha prime appears. So here we learn from this way of writing the action, we see that alpha prime has the interpretation as h bar, the quantization constant, on the world sheet sigma. So we associate to a Riemann surface, the Riemann surfaces, which are the world sheets of strings, some two-dimensional quantum field theory. Since it's a quantum field theory, it has a natural kind of Planck's constant. And the Planck's constant on the world sheet is played, the role of the Planck's constant on the world sheet is played by alpha prime. Another thing you see from this equation over here is that alpha prime can just be changed by changing the metric. Just by rescaling the metric, you can rid of alpha prime. So if you wish, if you have a metric, the metric has a typical distance associated to it, the typical size of the manifold. For instance, if you take a torus, we can think of a typical length of one of the radii, and by just rescaling that length, you can get rid of alpha prime. So another way to think about it, that the invariant thing, so is that so the volume, if you wish, of the manifold X, we can kind of, it will scale with this string scale to the power minus D. So we can think of this one parameter also as being the inverse, or some root of the inverse of the volume of the manifold X. So in particular, there's a limit, a natural limit to take, which is the limit alpha prime to zero, which is the semi-classical limit from the point of view of this two-dimensional quantum field theory, and which is the same thing as taking the volume of the manifold to infinity. Since the manifold is now infinitely big, somehow the size of the string compared to the volume of the manifold becomes very small. And so on this limit, we expect to recover quantum mechanics. So if you wish, this is the natural deformation parameter going from quantum mechanics to conformal field theory. So in particular, in this limit, we somehow expect roughly kind of a localization on constant loops. Of course, the space of constant loops sits inside the space of all loops. So expect that in this particular limit, the conformal field theory will degenerate to the quantum mechanical problem. It's actually quite beautiful to see how that happens in detail. One thing that will happen if you take that limit is that if you look at the spectrum of these operators L0 and L0 bar, they'll have a very complicated spectrum, which really kind of is a stringy in a sense that really depends on the size of these loops. But so it will have some kind of discrete spectrum. But in the limit where you set alpha prime to zero, you get states of very low energy, if you wish. And these are just, say, it's just the spectrum of the ordinary Laplacian on the manifold X. And these things will be typical string states, which will go to infinity in the limit where we send this volume to infinity, or alpha prime to zero. So we expect that this conformal field theory degenerates and essentially forms a quantum mechanical system. Now, in particular, this is the usual thing that people look at when they do quantum cohomology. The point of view being that the ground states of the conformal field theory, so the conformal field theory ground states, I'm doing this now very loosely, I will make it more precise later. So the states which have L0 on psi equals L0 bar on psi equals zero, and for the right class of conformal field theories, these are actually a one-to-one correspondence again to the harmonic states. on the manifold X. So we have a finite set of ground states in this conformal field theory. And what we now can look at is we can look at these correlation functions or these amplitudes that the conformal field theory associates to these ground states and compare them. We look at their alpha prime dependence. So if you have alpha, beta, gamma, this is the usual setup in quantum cohomology. Elements of this ground state, which we can identify with the cohomology of the manifold, and then look at this pair of pens diagram where we insert them, then this will typically have an expansion that looks like this. There's an integral over x of alpha wedge beta wedge gamma, which is just the classical or the thing coming from supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So this is not does not depend on alpha prime. But then there is a sum over gamma holomorphic maps, in this case of the Riemann sphere into x, and they will typically look like the degree over the map over alpha prime. And then there is here some integral of which I loosely write as follows, where this is the moduli space of maps of that particular degree. So the fact that these corrections go like so the natural expansion parameter in this case, so the usual expansion parameter in quantum cohomology, which is often called Q, would be 1 over minus 1 over alpha prime in terms of the, say, the two-dimensional Planck's constant that's naturally part of the formulation of the signal model. So here we really see how the conformal field theory is a one-parameter deformation of the usual classical geometry. So now we go to the proper subject of my lectures, which is the third level, which is we could call M theory or non-perturbative strings. And I would love to say here that, well, for quantum mechanics we consider point particles, for conformal field theory we consider loops, and for M theory we consider membranes or something, but that's unfortunately not the state of the situation. We don't really know at this point what is the right kind of starting point for a non-perturbative formulation of M theory. We only know certain answers to certain questions, and that will be one of the important aspects of my lectures, is that it will be very kind of impressionistic, because I only will be able to tell about little aspects of what kind of the M theory is, and we won't have a really nice consistent picture developed, say, at the level of rigor that you could develop conformal field theory. So the important point is so the first thing is to stress that there is the second deformation parameter, which is the string coupling. And I will write it as G string. And it enters in the following way. Well, as we said, if you have a Riemann surface, say, of genus H, then to this we will associate some amplitude A of H, which in general, in the way I was setting it up, was a function on the space of moduli of the Riemann surface. But this is a generalization of the setup of conformal field theory, where you also include ghosts and other ingredients of string theory. But this actually is a volume form. I mean, I'll come back to that later. That A of H is a volume form on this moduli space M of H. So what that means is that you can now compute a function, say, of this one parameter GS. We want to, actually, somehow the goal is to find a function of this single parameter which has the property that it has a consistent expansion as a power series in powers of the string coupling constant. Actually, here we will have, we raise it to the Euler number of the Riemann surface, times the integral of this amplitude over the moduli space M of H. But in general, we'll see that these objects A of G will not be defined through this Taylor series expansion. So important to say that this is generically only an asymptotic expansion. And there will be corrections to that, very much as there were kind of corrections in the through this kind of instanton sum here on the world sheet. There will be here corrections, which will typically go like e to the power minus 1 over g string, so things that you don't see in the Taylor expansion, and so which somehow don't have a straightforward interpretation in terms of Riemann surfaces. So this part here is what's called perturbative string theory. Kind of the art of writing down this natural class of volume forms on the moduli space. There's already very non-trivial aspect that these things can be properly defined and that they have the property also that their integrals over the moduli space are not divergent, so we get some numbers out of it. But then it somehow didn't suffice. We don't take just this sum over Riemann surfaces. We really want to find the so-called non-perturbative aspect. So this is the non-perturbative answer. And so the aim of M-theory, non-perturbative string theory, is to find or define these objects here on the left-hand side. So kind of the philosophical point is that we're looking at some structure, some mathematical structure, that depends on this deformation parameter, this parameter G string, and which allows for an expansion in terms of Riemann surfaces. So Riemann surfaces are not a starting point, or loops are not a starting point of string theory. They should come out by studying its asymptotics. So if you wish, this is some kind of a diagram even. So since we have these two parameters, we can kind of look at some kind of a phase diagram of string theory. So on the one hand, we have this parameter alpha prime, or L string, the typically length of a string. The other one, we have this coupling constant G string. So alpha prime can be thought of as being kind of so if we think in a perturbative regime where we have maps of a Riemann surface sigma into a space-time X, this alpha prime will be Planck's constant on this two-dimensional Riemann surface, while G string, since that somehow the expansion in G string is in terms of adding more and more handles or loops to this Riemann surface, the G string is really the thing which behaves like Planck's constant in space-time. So we have two Planck's constants, two ways in which we have like a quantum deformation in the space-time or on the world sheet. In that sense, we have now a two-dimensional phase diagram. So if G string is very small and alpha prime is very small, we are here in this lower left-hand corner. So here is quantum mechanics, or particles. And so the Feynman diagrams that I was drawing, I was looking only at very simple Feynman diagrams, but you can take more general diagrams and compute these diagrams essentially using this formulation of quantum mechanics that I gave you in terms of a Hilbert space and an evolution operator, just doing these things together. So here we have Feynman diagrams. And this is, say, the simplest aspect of the theory. Then if you tune up this parameter alpha prime, if you wish these one-dimensional edges and lines, they become two-dimensional. And so here we are in the realm of conformal field theory, or strings. And the things that we study there are kind of Riemann surfaces. So we deformed this diagram into a two-dimensional Riemann surface. If we take this quantum mechanics limits and turn up the string coupling constant, what we are doing is we are summing over Feynman diagrams. And summing over diagrams is what usually is called quantum field theory. I mean, it leads to quantum field theory. It's perturbative quantum field theory, but we know how to, in many cases, how to lift that to a non-perturbative level. So here we have the notion of fields. And one particular field would be very important for us, which is the metric on the space. So this is also the realm where we have, say, gravity or supergravity. So here we have like non-trivial field configurations, like for instance a black hole or something. So now the question is, so this is kind of a little jigsaw puzzle with one puzzle missing. Question is, what sits in here? So M theory is kind of a nice M for mystery. It's not quite clear what is here the essential or fundamental formulation. Perhaps there is none. We have different formulations in different corners. But one thing that we will see, that an important role here will be played by gate theories. So all the places where we know somehow an answer to the what a possible definition of non-perturbative string theory, they all involve gate theories at the fundamental level. If you wish, you can, if you just want to compare this little plot with kind of the various applications in mathematics, so you can draw a similar diagram. So, for instance, well, as I said, here we have Feynman diagrams or combinatorics. So typical subjects are that make use of this formulation are kind of finite type manifold invariants. They have three manifolds and of knots. So Koncevich is somebody who really developed, of course, that point of view. Here we have a non-trivial field theory. So typical subjects that belong, say, to this lower right-hand corner are things like index theory, well, Donaldson invariants, and things that really are not done in terms of, say, combinatorics, but really in terms of non-trivial field configurations, like instantons or things like that. Up here, we have Gromov-Witten theory. We have, of course, the theory of, say, affine Kac-Moody algebras. All the beautiful applications are the and more generalizations like vertex algebras. Typical things that two-dimensional conformal field theory led to. And the kind of mathematical applications of M-theory are, at this moment, I think, very little. But one important ingredient seemed to be non-commutative geometry. If only because we have seen that the few examples that we do know what M-theory is involve matrices or gauge fields. So what I'm certainly not claiming that this will be the only mathematics involved, but it certainly seems to be an important ingredient. So does anybody has a question about this this kind of phase diagram and this setup? Well, the important thing is that what we want to study is the non-perturbative regime of string theory. And it's the way gate theories will appear is not that, say, the H-bar of string theory will be the H-bar of gate theory. Because what has this what does this H-bar have to do? It has somehow have the property that you have some kind of mathematical structure, and its asymptotic expansion gives Riemann surfaces. And so it will be, in these cases, typically like large N expansion of the gate theory. So we essentially are looking at systems which naturally carry two parameters. And gate theories will be examples for that because they have, apart from the Planck's constant, they also have, of the coupling constant, they have a second parameter, which is the rank of the gate group. And that will be play an important role in the in building up this kind of the second dimension. So, just to give a few examples of the kind of structures that we want to explain. So there will be two essential, so the thing is, of course, so what structure allows for this expansion in these two parameters, alpha prime and g string. And two important aspects of M theory play a role in the rest of my lecture. So the first aspect is that alpha prime, we say, is related to the volume of our target space X. So it's an example of a so-called geometric modulus. In general, we have many more moduli than just the volume of the manifold. We have like also the various, well, for instance, we want to have pick a Ricci flat metric on X, and we'll have some non-trivial family of these metrics. And one of the parameters will be the overall volume. So alpha prime has a natural geometric interpretation from the point of view of the target space X. But G string does not. It's just some formal parameter that keeps track of the number of holes you punch in your Riemann surface. So one important aspect that we will meet is the following statement. That so this looks like not geometric, G string. But one thing that we will see in M theory and is the following, that string theory on the manifold X with the string coupling constant G string, and this will be typically will be for a particular class of string theory, so-called 2A string, that this will have a geometrical interpretation in terms of the manifold X times a circle, where the radius of this circle of the S1 will be related to the parameter G string. So we will have situations where we will identify this extra parameter as a geometric object, namely the radius of some extra space-time dimension that hasn't been is not obvious from the point of view of the conformal field theory. So this is what's often called proper M theory, in the sense that lives in a space-time of one dimension higher than the dimension that you see from the string or the conformal field theory point of view. This will have some interesting consequences. For instance, I will actually explain at some point in one very particular case, we have our manifold X, and as I said, we want to associate to it, well, say this amplitude A, which depends on this, well, depends both on the string coupling constant and on alpha prime, if we write it correctly, so this two-parameter function. And you naturally expect this to be just say, a function in some way naturally associated to this manifold X. But then there will be a different interpretation where we're not looking at this manifold X, but we're looking at something which, say, is X times a circle. So there's an extra kind of S1 added to it. And what it will mean is that we can, as we did precisely also in two dimensions, that we can associate objects, we can compute things that are associated to the manifold X by doing this computation in this space-time which has one extra dimension. And so, since we now have one extra dimension, we can take this extra dimension somehow roughly to be time, and we expect that this A will be the trace, so I'm kind of writing this kind of very loosely, as some of some exponential. And actually turns out that here will be G string times the Hamiltonian. Some Hamiltonian that describes the propagation in this extra dimension. So the fact that we have this kind of extra dimension appearing in the formulation will allow us to do some non-trivial computations on the right-hand side. But the very non-trivial ingredient is that this geometric object, if we shrink the circle to become very small, it should somehow give rise to a sum over Riemann surfaces here in this manifold X. And that's a very non-trivial statement.
Is that lifetime?
Sorry?
What kind of time is that?
No. I mean, this is the 11th. I think of it in terms of a Euclidean formulation, I should say. So if you have a, let's say...
So you're not trying to motivate
with life partly, but I just want to stress that there is an extra direction and you can somehow associate an operator that describes propagation in that direction. And then you can trace over it.
Question about your amplitude as a function of GS.
Yes.
GS is sort of a formal expansion on surfaces, which you can't really compute.
No. So we only know its expansion, and we don't know the function itself.
Right. So it's a formal object which you're going to try and compute by
Somehow we tried, of course, to jump up to the next level by kind of giving a definition, which has the property that it's for a small g string, it coincides with the rules that we get from conformal field theory, but it should provide extra information. So there's no way in which, say, just knowing about conformal field theory will tell you about the M theory or non-perturbative answer, how it will look like. In the same way that just starting from quantum mechanics, it's hard to guess what this quantum deformation is, this parameter alpha prime.
So you'll get at the A on the left-hand side by finding the right-hand side and seeing what happens as GS gets smaller.
Precisely, precisely. But the thing I just want to point out here as kind of to set out the stage is that one way in which the coupling constant will appear is as the length of an extra dimension. So we have to somehow understand how reducing on that dimension somehow gives rise to Riemann surfaces. So that's one ingredient that we'll be using. A second ingredient that we'll be using is that, as I already mentioned, that gate theory plays an important role. So we also make use of gate series. Say, where we have some gauge group UN. And then the string coupling constant will in many cases be naturally identified with 1 over N. But we consider these gate series not for fixed N, let's say, and make N the rank of the gauge group a second variable. So we also see that in these cases we naturally get sum over Riemann surfaces. Again, just to set the stage of the kind of structures that you want to explain, and one thing that we want to explain is what are the natural symmetries. So, okay, we have this manifold X, and we somehow quantize it on either of these three levels. And this gives also rise to a natural symmetry group, which is often called the duality group. Let's call it just G of X. So one important part in the story is, of course, how do you want to think about this manifold X? It's clearly that it's not enough just to think about it as a manifold. But for instance, if you make the step from manifolds for quantum mechanics to conformal field theory, you will just see that there are many more conformal field theories than just manifolds. So somehow we think of a manifold as being an element in a bigger class of objects, which contain, say, arbitrary conformal field theories. And that means that we also see, and very concretely, that there are extra parameters that you can associate to a manifold once you see it at the right level. So within the realm of conformal field theory, manifolds carry extra geometric structures. And that means also that their symmetries, the natural symmetry group associated to such an object, can be bigger than just the classical symmetry. So if you have just a Riemannian manifold, you would say that the natural symmetry group is just a group of isometries of the manifold. But when it's a conformal field theory, you look at the symmetries of the conformal field theory, there might be symmetries that don't have a classical interpretation. And even if you go to N theory, there might be even more symmetries. So a good example of that, which actually will somehow be a red line during my lectures, if you take the manifold to be, say, a d-dimensional torus, then we can look at what are the natural symmetries associated to that torus. So if we look from the point of view of a particle, well, we're just looking at, say, quantum mechanics. But just the wave function is just a function, an ordinary function, on this torus. And the only symmetries that are naturally carried by these objects are the symmetries of the torus itself. So the kind of this group G of X will just be the group SLBZ, which are just the non-trivial diffeomorphisms acting on a d-dimensional torus. And it's nice to kind of draw the Dinkin diagram. So this is the Dinkin diagram, say A D minus 1, of the corresponding Lie algebra. Now if we go from particles to conformal field theory, conformal field theory associated to a d-dimensional torus has a symmetry group Gx, which is the group ODDZ. So I'll explain that in more detail, but that will be the thing that comes out, which is the Dinkin diagram, by adding, say, an extra root. So this is the Dinkin diagram DD. So we get a symmetry group that certainly contains SLDZ, but has also extra symmetries that don't have a geometric interpretation. So within the space of conformal field theories, certainly conformal field theory on that torus carries more symmetries than just the things that would act on the usual function space of the torus. And then finally, if we lift to the case of M theory, where again we have more parameters, certainly we have this parameter which is the string coupling constant. So from the point of M theory, it will turn out that the natural symmetry group is the group ED plus 1 Z, some particular realization of that discrete version of that corresponding Lie group, which in terms of the corresponding Dinkin diagram now looks like this, where here we added an extra node to it. So this group is certainly, the groups are of course a whole series of, this is a subgroup of this group, and this group is a subgroup of the exceptional group. So one thing that we are asking for is, whatever this mathematical structure is, if you, in that proper context, if you take a d-dimensional torus, this would be somehow, in a natural way, its automorphism group. And that's by itself, I think, already a very astonishing statement, because this is a very non-trivial symmetry group.
Which of the two ones with one color pink can repeat this?
Yes. So the question is, how do, and we will actually, in some sense, we are certainly not at the stage of development where we understand this for arbitrary D, but there are some very non-trivial examples where we understand this. So a particular example I will concentrate on at some point is the case D equals 4. So that's a case where our manifold is a 4 torus. And then we have this series of groups, SL4Z, sitting in the group O44Z, sitting inside a group which I would like to call E5, but actually in this case E5 is defined to be the group O55Z. Just happens to be the right way to interpret what E5 is. So somehow I want to see, what is the mathematical structure that gives this series of groups? Because this is somehow the structure that we should get when we send our string coupling constant to zero. So this is the symmetry seen by the conformal field theory. And then if we take this limit alpha prime to zero, if you wish, make the torus very large, then only this part, the obvious SL4, should survive that particular limit. Well, actually, this is somehow the end of my introduction. So, if I think for me it would be actually a good point to stop, because I will discuss conformal field theories after this, and so perhaps we can discuss a little bit more or ask questions about what I talked about today at this point.
I mean, so you're saying that you will really example that, I mean, in your example, you will actually be able to see this.
Yes, so yes. So, yes, precisely. So I will do an example where I can do certain computations where we see actually this symmetry group appearing. But what it will have to do is it has to, it's not something we can just see on the level of Riemann surfaces of conformal field theory. So one thing that it should do is somehow map these answers that we get from Riemann surfaces and map it to something very differently, somehow extra objects. So we will see that this symmetry, one way we will interpret it, that symmetry, is that that there are objects that you can, I mean, you can study things using conformal field theory or Riemann surfaces, and you can compute objects in a different way, and this symmetry group will actually interchange these two formulations. So we'll see that, I mean, the question you could ask, if this is a symmetry of the system,
right,
what will it do if it acts on a Riemann surface?
Right.
And what will it map to? It won't be a Riemann surface anymore, because within the context of Riemann surfaces, only this group will be visible. So it will somehow probe or give us these extra mathematical structures that are sitting there. And, these will turn out to be D-brains, but it will be, we'll see actually that this symmetry group is somehow interchanging strings or Riemann surfaces with other objects that are naturally part of the theory. So we have to somehow supplement the theory of Riemann surface with extra objects. And then when we add these extra objects, these bigger symmetry groups naturally will appear. That's somehow the thing that we're aiming for. Right.
In your models, GS tends to be 1/(1/D) of a large space group.
Yes.
Presumably, at some point, you can choose this number.
Yes.
Is it simply that God chose a group, or did he just choose a value?
Well, in these particular models, they somehow are right. I mean, I'm not quite sure what the right answer to give is. I mean, one way you could say this is somehow that there's a natural kind of quantization of this string coupling constant in kind of 1/(integers), because these are the ranks of the gauge group. But we do not believe that this coupling constant by itself is quantized. So we somehow believe that the theory makes sense for arbitrary, say, value of n, which somehow interpolates in the between the integers, I think. So there's no natural quantization coming out. I mean, of course, there is this issue that alpha prime sometimes can be quantized. Like if you do if X is like a Lie group, we know that alpha prime is not really a continuous parameter, but it takes, it's actually quantized in roughly in terms of 1/(k), where k is the level of the Lie, of the affine Kac-Moody-Lie algebra. But in these cases, I don't think we want to interpret it, this as a quantization of the string coupling constant. So somehow I want to make sense of the 1/(n) expansion of the gate theory for arbitrary n.
I wonder if you could expand on what you meant by the string coupling constant. At the moment, it's simply a formal parameter in the expansion in terms of the
yes.
genus of the surface.
Yes.
Presumably, it means a lot more to you than that.
Well, I mean, there are two aspects in which we kind of understand the kind of notion of the string coupling constant. So one is actually kind of in this corner, and one is in this corner. So here we explained it in terms of counting over the different topologies, weighing the different topologies of the sum of Riemann surfaces. Here, in this particular limit, you want to think about G string. Oh, there you somehow go to kind of classical or semi-classical gravity. So there is a, so from the point of, say, supergravity, we will have some typical Einstein action. And there, the string coupling constant appears. This is the place to look to see that it actually plays the role of a Planck's constant, or actually the square of it in this case plays the role of a Planck's constant in space-time. So that means that if you somehow want to treat quantize gravity in a kind of standard perturbative way, you will draw Feynman diagrams here. So if you now do kind of semi-classical quantization, you get the Feynman diagrams. Which are, is the things that appear over here. So here we got certain Feynman diagrams. And then G-string will control the, again, the expansion in terms of these Feynman diagrams. So this is certainly the place where you see that it should appear as a Planck's constant. But, I mean, in some sense, actually, I think the part of the story in the last couple of years is to get a good intuition for what the string coupling constant is, apart from just being the sum over topologies. And we only have kind of a very limited understanding. Yeah?
Extension of this Feynman diagram. Actually, for generic quantum field, do we have already a two-parameter extension in quantum field diagram? One is this coupling constant, the other one is the UV short distance curve, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
So how does the parameter fit into the whole picture? Well, let's put example, the new proposal is gauge theory as M theory definition.
Yes.
Well, that contains the definite extension
inside. Yes. So, I mean, the first thing, of course, to mention is that, in general, there will be many more parameters, of course, when we start to compactify, and are in, so in general, you have only kind of two parameters in the, say, kind of in 10-dimensional string theory.
I mentioned already non-compactify.
Yes. Yes. Well, in that case, I would say that this, I mean, alpha prime is typically giving you the. I mean, you're thinking about the Planck length as being an extra
parameter. Just gauge theory, or quantum theory.
Yes.
We have to specify about the color.
Right? Yes.
And next double extension in bare coupling constant as well as extra extension.
Yes.
So one is this horizontal line. What are extra parameters?
But you're thinking about a gauge theory where you don't have a running of a coupling constant or something, but.
Right.
Yes. Yes, I mean, that's certainly, so I would say in the analog there, this is like the coupling constant of the gauge theory, and this would be kind of the length scale of the theory. Yeah, I understand your point, but, yes. 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 Yeah, I'm a little bit confused. Somehow, I don't have a good answer to that.
Would you consider that as a spontaneous integration?
This over here? I guess, yes, you can, because, in the sense that, spontaneous breaking, it's not quite clear what kind of the order parameter is or something, but certainly it's true that you somehow single out a particular parameter or something, and by singling out that parameter, you break the group to a subgroup, namely the group that kind of preserves that parameter. In that sense, it's you can perhaps think about it a little bit as symmetry breaking. So if you just look at the symmetries that kind of keep this constant fixed, then you naturally get a subgroup, which is the subgroup of the conformal field theory, because that's this symmetry group acts, say, for every Riemann surface. This group only becomes visible the moment we sum over all Riemann surfaces. So if you're somehow by picking out a particular string diagram or something, you break the symmetry from here to there. That's one way to think about it. Okay. I'll finish here.